What up? It's Adam Ray for the About Last Night podcast. I got a question for you guys. Do you know what the only thing better than winning your fantasy football league is? Do you? I think you do, but I'm going to tell you anyway. It's constantly reminding the other owners that you did. That's what I'm talking about. And at DraftKings.com, you can prove that you're the superior GM every week, all right? If you don't know what DraftKings is, you should by the end of this ad, all right? DraftKings is America's favorite one-week fantasy football site. One-week fantasy, that means no season-long commitments, all right? 1 week, so you can play whenever you want in a variety of contests, all right? Challenge your friends. You got friends, right?
Yes.
Well, challenge them in a custom league or join an existing one to play for your share of the millions of dollars in prizes that are up for grabs this season. Here's what you got to do. Just pick your contest, draft your players, and collect your winnings, your money, your dough, your dollars. That's it. Renew old rivalries and create new ones with your buddies by playing head-to-head with friends, coworkers, and fantasy players from all over the country. You could be playing a guy in Pakistan, a guy in Peru, and a guy in Burbank. It's that fucking cool. All right, so hurry to DraftKings.com right now. Use the promo code ALN and play for free with your first deposit in this Sunday's $1 million fantasy contest. Did you hear me? This Sunday's $1 million fantasy contest. Play for free using promo code ALN, okay? First place takes home 100 grand and a lifetime of bragging rights. This isn't fantasy as usual, baby. This is DraftKings. Welcome to the big time. Enter ALN for free entry now only at DraftKings.com. That's DraftKings.com. Go Seahawks. Fuck the Broncos. Sorry, Brad. Hey, everybody, it's Adam Ray and Brad Williams for the About Last Night podcast.
I'm here for this one.
Yes.
Woohoo!
Finally. This guest, I didn't think was even in the realm of possibility.
Right?
Because neither one of us know or knew him personally.
Right. We wouldn't even know how to get in touch with him.
Our guest today is the one and only, a guy whose career who spans over 30 years.
Yeah.
The voice of Bobby from Bobby's World, created that show. The voice of Gizmo and Gremlins. The host of one of the most successful, if not the most successful, game show globally of all time, Deal or No Deal.
Judge on America's Got Talent.
Author, critically acclaimed stand-up comedian.
He put a damn rubber glove on his head, Adam.
We're talking about Howie Mandel.
Howie Mandel.
Brad met Howie Mandel at the Laugh Factory.
I did.
And you shoot me a text. You go, I'm here with Howie Mandel. I'm talking. I'm going to try to get him on the podcast. I texted back a dick pic. And then I said, I'm sorry. That was not for you. No, that is not true. I've never sent a dick pic. On record, I've never sent a dick pic.
You know what? You say that, but it was a solid girth.
I can't do it. I'm talking about this on stage now. I go, I can't send a dick pic. I go, but I still want to give girls what they want. So I send them a picture of a guy in a Hummer parking in a handicap spot. And I go, there, are you satisfied?
I just send a picture of Dick Van Dyke, but that works better.
Nice. Nice. I'll add that to the joke.
Exactly. Do it.
So you meet him.
Yeah, and he was so nice. And comics just have that bond where as soon as another comic comes up to you and says, hey, I'm a comedian. Immediately, all shields are down. Yeah. You're like, oh, great, I can talk
to you. We're in the same world.
I can relate to you. And we talk for a bit, and I say, I got this podcast. It's fun. We've had, and I go through the people that we've had on, which is
Rolodex.
Huge, by the way, when you talk about Paul Feig, Melissa McCarthy, Dana Carvey, Kevin Neal, all the people.
Saget,
it
makes people go, oh, cool. It helps to legitimize.
Absolutely.
Like, when we were starting out, and no knock to them, but when we were like, yo, we've had on, you know, Dennis Haskins,
who
and,
personal hero of ours, but maybe
to us that was a big deal.
Yeah,
but
for someone else,
that was not helping
like,
us get Tony
great.
Danza.
Yeah, yeah so which you know, helping us getting Tony Danza, that was the goal the entire time.
Yeah,
now we're just playing with house money. So I tell him about that, and then I say, hey, I got to go on stage, and he says, I will watch your set, and I go, oh, okay, great.
And yeah. So in your head, you're thinking, okay, crush hard as possible.
Do all the nuts. Hits. Playing the hits. If now that's what I call music, had a collection of
dwarf jokes.
Of dwarf jokes. Play those. We want to hear Lenny Kravitz Fly Away for the ninth time.
If, by the way, that's what if they run out of hit songs, and now that's what I call music 49, or is all Brad Williams material?
Now that's what I call music, volume 127. It's your favorite dwarf jokes of all time. Wait, 19 tracks by Brad Williams.
Wait, sung by OMC.
How bizarre.
Yeah.
Okay. I get off stage and I walk right up to where I know Howie's going to be, which is up in the little balcony area of the Laugh Factory. And Howie just looks at me and he points at me and goes, I will do your podcast.
Wow.
And I'm like, wow, yeah.
Brad, you basically, your set was the audition to have him on the podcast.
Pretty much. He based the entire experience off of that.
You did a set in Crush. You didn't stand up there and go, I will kill myself if Howie Mandel does not do my podcast.
Well, I mean, that was my closer. Yeah. Naturally.
Well, that was incredible, and that was an even more incredible text to receive on my end because, yeah. Again, a juggernaut of this business, man. And as you guys will hear in this episode, hearing these stories of
incredible.
Of Gremlins and Bobby's World and how Deal or No Deal how it happened is mind-blowing because of the presentation and how against doing a game show he was.
He didn't want to do it.
And just also his insight on 30 years of the business,
right?
Dealing with OCD.
And you know, he's the guy that he doesn't shake your hand. He gives you a fist bump.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, and then he talks a little bit about that. And just, I forget, and he talked about this in the episode, where I forget that he is a working comedian still. And you hear it in this episode, how funny he is, how quick he is, how he yes-ands everything.
How when he's going on the road to do corporate gigs, he'll pop into comedy clubs to work on material. I mean, it's like it doesn't stop. And that's the great thing about when you really get into the nitty-gritty of being a comic, it's like the work doesn't stop.
Right.
And, you know, you and I both have said it, and we do it sometimes. We're in certain cities. If we meet comics after the show, and they're like, oh, we're going to do this open mic, you know, after doing an hour, 2 hour shows, we'll go, eh, fuck it, let's pop in and do it.
Do an open mic, because why not?
Not doing them in L.A. Anymore, because I think it's part of the process. You graduate to the next level, and you don't go back and do those. But to never think you're above doing that.
Yeah, and never stop getting better.
And
Howie's definitely doing that.
And also, he's just, it's so inspiring for me to be like, wow, you have done so much, and you're still so funny and so generous. And I felt very comfortable with him. Like, you had had that rapport. I had nothing. And we improvised. I'm not going to say the name of the show that we opened with.
It's good.
I didn't know how the first few minutes were going to go. We ended up improvising a fake reality show.
You'll like it.
Just enjoy it. Listen to it. And tweet at Howie. Tell him how much you love him. Tweet at him at Howie Mandel on Twitter. Tweet at us at Adam Ray Comedy, at Funny Brad.
And now, at the brand new About Last Night podcast Twitter. Yes, follow the About Last Night podcast on Twitter to get all the news about.
What's that Twitter handle?
ALN Podcast. That's ALN Podcast.
Yeah.
Follow us. You get tons of information about the podcast, about us when we're doing stand up, and just random funny things that we'll find entertaining.
Yep. Our boy Norman is helping us run that, and he's just going on a fucking tweet rampage and helping grow the pod and keep you guys up to date on everything. So follow that ALN podcast and come see us live. Brad, where are you going to be?
November 12th and 13th. I'm going to be in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm going to be at the Improv November 12th and 13th, and also going to my favorite barbecue joint, Oklahoma Joe's Barbecue.
Yeah.
I will be there.
It's at a gas station, right?
It is at a gas station. It is awesome. So I will be there in Kansas City at the Improv. Rochester, New York, November 19th through the 21st. I will be at the Comedy Club. That's right. It's called the Comedy Club, and it's in Rochester, New York, November 19th through 21st. And then Thanksgiving weekend, Burbank, California, November 27th to the 28th. I'm going to be at Flappers doing 4 shows Thanksgiving weekend. You got relatives coming in. You're getting annoyed because your aunt is telling the story about how you pissed your pants at the third grade recital for the 9th time. I'm not saying this from some personal experience.
You are.
Damn it. So you want to get away from them, come see me at Flappers in Burbank that weekend. Adam, where are you going to be, my friend?
Well, this Wednesday, November 11th, I will be at the Lyric Theater in Los Angeles, California, with Elijah Schlesinger, Steve Ranazzisi for the Super Secret Show. Come see that.
It's no longer a secret.
It's not a secret. It's actually quite well known. The Lyric Theater, Los Angeles, California, November 11th at 8 o'clock. And then November 24th, I'll be headlining the Irvine Improv at 8 p.m. in Irvine, California. And then San Francisco, California, I'm coming to you guys November 25th through the 28th over Thanksgiving weekend at one of my favorite clubs in the world, The Punchline in San Fran, November 25th through the 28th. And then right after that, I'll be going to West Nyack, New York. It's about 45 minutes outside of the city at Levity Live. First time there. You've done it.
I'm going to do it.
You're going to do it.
Yeah. And
but you've done it.
Yeah. It's great.
Great club. West Nyack, New York. Levity Live. Come see me December 3rd through December 5th. And come out to the shows. And, of course, bring your merch. Your merch. Your shirts. Your mugs. I was just in Tempe.
And where can you get these About Last Night podcast shirts and mugs, Adam Ray?
www.estoymerchandise.com.
There you go.
ESTOYmerchandise.com. Get your ALN merch. Bring it to the shows. I was just in Tempe and signed maybe 9 mugs. And that was...
That's mugs, not jugs?
They were mugs on jugs.
Mugs on jugs.
I signed mugs.
That's my favorite Saturday morning cartoon. How did you know that?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Mugs on Jugs.
Hey.
Well, basically, we just see how many coffee mugs we can stack on top of big old titties. We'll be right back.
It's like, what? I would love to watch that.
Yeah.
Yes, bring your About Last Night podcast merchandise. We will sign it. We'll take pictures with you. We will retweet those pictures because we like meeting you guys.
We like meeting you guys. And, I mean, some of the stories from fans coming up at shows is really awesome. And the letters and emails we've been getting just of how much the pod is a part of your life is kind of mind-blowing and really makes it extra special because we love doing this. And so to hear that you guys love listening is awesome. So many great episodes coming down the pipeline. A couple more best ofs. We got part 2 and part 3 coming up. Yeah. A holiday special episode with Jaleel White is in the works.
All right.
So much fun. Those are the Twitter handles. That's the merch info. Those are the tour dates. And now sit back, relax, and enjoy a very special, very, very special episode of the About Last Night podcast
with Mr. Howie Mandel.
Well, the weekend's over, so it's time to chat about it. Got a midget and a Jew, so why don't you sit down and listen to our dope podcast during lunch, dinner, or breakfast. Brad Williams and Adam Ray are here for you any time of the day. So come on and treat yourself right. It's About Last Night.
How long have you had this spectacular warehouse here?
I've had this warehouse for about a year now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's spectacular. It's a warehouse, but it's right in the heart of where it all happens.
Yeah, the porn valley, you mean?
I'm in the heart of it. You know, it's very funny because I was looking at a warehouse for years. We had offices on the lot at Universal,
mm-hmm.
And I wanted to have my own.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to be renting offices at so I started looking. I thought the Valley, and I wanted to be in the Valley, and I thought I want to be close to film.
Mm-hmm.
So what film is done in the Valley?
Porn, right?
So when I was looking at warehouses, because I had a lot to do, a lot came with showers, a lot came with mattresses, a lot came with...
Oh, God, used,
you know,
or
but
new?
This was an actual warehouse. They were actually manufacturing. So I took this and kind of gutted it and built...
Now, I want to know, did you bring in the ping pong table, or are porn stars big pong players?
There was no porn in here, but the building next door is porn.
Yeah,
right.
You know, so...
I thought you were about to say it's haunted, but maybe it is haunted by porn.
Porn haunted. Has there been like a haunted porn?
No, but they're probably... Well,
there should be. Should there be like ghost hunters, but instead that they just go to like old porn sets and be like, if you can hear us, give us a sign, make some jism drop from the ceiling.
Ghost hunters. That's what it'd be. I think it's haunted in there.
Yeah.
Let's go in. You know, that makes sense, because when there's a haunted house and then they get out, you see those movies. I don't really like horror movies because it's bullshit. Like, if you were scared, why would you go back in?
Yeah. Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But if you thought a vagina was haunted, Everybody would go back in and then out and then in and then back in again.
It's the power
and
of that product.
I think I left my cat in there. Let me go back in. It's the power of pussy.
Yeah, I mean, that would be something to where when your friend is bragging about how he's had like a Maxim model or something, you would kind of be able to look at and be like, you ever have ghost pussy?
Oh, my God.
Doesn't compare. Wow, doesn't compare.
But I just, the only part of it, I don't mind the hauntings and the sounds coming out of there and the creaking and that. It's cobwebs. You don't want cobwebs in there.
You don't.
No.
You don't ever want cobwebs.
Not in there.
If you take anything away from this podcast and Howie Mandel, you don't want
cobwebs. Something is tickling your face. I don't think that's, whoa, did you hear that? Let's go in deeper. Let's go in deeper.
See this is what I love about you, Howie, is you just kind of, and no matter what you're doing in your career, you've always been great at improv. You've always been able to just kind of go. And
I don't know that that's improvisation. Is that considered improvisation?
Was that a bit? Brad, that was his Ghost Hunters bit.
Oh,
you haven't heard
it? The world famous Ghost Hunter bit.
Yeah, for years. I saw an old Carson clip where you were running it on the show. Yeah.
Ghost Hunter. But I'm getting a reading. You know what? That would be, I'm not a single guy, but I'm not married, but that would be, I would actually use that as a pickup line.
Sure.
They find that if you believe, you could talk to women, if mm-hmm. and you tell the women that you believe, what is it called when you're possessed?
Yes. Yeah.
How does a spirit get into you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Through your vagina.
Yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to attach a little meter to the end of my penis.
Yeah.
And it's not, we're not fucking.
No.
No. No.
Get that out of your head, Suzanne.
No. Yeah. I'm ghost hunting.
Ghost hunting.
What I'm
There's
doing
a difference if you
I
would
just
listen.
Want to get a reading.
Yeah.
I just want to get a reading.
I'm going to put a crystal
and
on the end
sure
of my
that
dick.
It's all clean in here.
Yeah.
And the whole family can move it.
This house is clear.
Yes. Because I once met the Amityville whore.
The Amityville whore. Not horror.
No, the Amityville whore.
Whore. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Because a family was once massacred in her vagina years ago, and then another family moves in.
Wait, and then the walls of the vagina just start talking like, yes. Get out. Like that.
Nice.
Come in.
Come again. Nice.
Wow.
Can so that's
imagine? Nobody does that. Is are there porn horrors?
Porn.
There's got to be. Porn has parodied. I feel like most everything. Because then I've seen sketches where they are you know doing parodies of parodies.
Yeah.
I want to just say one thing because you are a master of voices. Now Brad just took a stab at a potential voice of the vagina in that scenario.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as a guy who does voices on the reg, do you think that would be the go-to,
or do you have, if you were to do a voice of a vagina, would there be some other take on
we
it?
We like to ask the hard-hitting questions on this podcast.
That's good. Hello. Hello. Where did that come from? It's got to come from like inside the pants or beneath the dress.
Yeah, right.
Hello. It's got to be tight-lipped.
Yes.
Yeah,
well,
you can't
enunciate.
Hello.
Pun intended. Tight-lipped. Yes.
Hello. Hello.
It sounds like an older Skeeter.
Skeeter is a good name for that. Did you see her Skeeter?
What? See it?
Oh my God!
I lived in it.
You
want her to have a Skeeter rather than an animal.
Muppet Babies is forever changed for me. I'm never gonna look at this. Oh God! I mean, that my childhood is just taking a dramatic turn for I don't know the worst.
Always entertaining.
How did the gig of Muppet Babies even come to be? Were you already well?
I had one voice. You know, I do different voices,
yeah.
But I got hired to do. I did that voice, the Bobby voice.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, I was choking on something. At a birthday party, and mm-hmm. when your voice is having, you know, people say, "How do you do that?" And it's not like a falsetto where you try to talk high.
Right.
That's not what it is. But when my throat was half closed, so something was halfway down my throat, and I don't try this at home. But I was choking on something.
Are we still talking about porn?
We can get all segue into porn.
Jesus, Brad. Okay. We're trying to transition.
Sorry.
You know when you take a balloon and you blow up a balloon and then you stretch the nipple?
Here yes, we go. Yes.
You stretch the nipple of the balloon and it squeezes out at a high note.
Right.
I was trying to get air out. I had something halfway down my throat and I'm going, help me. Help me. I can't. Oh my
That's
God.
That's the voice that was coming out.
That was the voice. And people are laughing and I'm dying. And then luckily it got dislodged and I lived. But I thought to myself, this was an amazing, besides a near-death experience.
Sure.
I had an audience. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to replicate.
How old were you
at that
age?
Probably 11 or 12.
So wow. That was maybe your first recognition of like, oh, like you
no,
getting.
Nobody really enjoyed me, but they were looking and fascinated by the voice. I mean, I was just at the birthday party gotcha. Because it was a cousin.
Right. Death, you know? And, death and
but
funny
then
sounds.
I learned to make that voice. I trained the muscles in my throat to tighten my throat, and I can yeah. squeeze the air through. I can do that voice when I have no voice, when laryngitis, because it's only air.
Right.
I'm doing it with air.
Oh, shit.
You know, I'm just pushing air through. Like the top of a balloon when you stretch a balloon.
Yeah.
You know, so, and then I would go to school, and in the back of the class, I could go, help me. And people would laugh. The teacher would catch me and go, Howie, if you have something funny to say,
yeah.
tell the whole class. I talked yeah. about that in my act.
Yeah.
But anyway, I started doing that voice. And when I came out here and did comedy, in stand-up comedy, I was doing that on stage, mm-hmm. the voice, as a, you know, a baby talking filthy.
Right, because you didn't have, like, you didn't have the idea of Bobby's World in your head like that or
no it yeah. was in my knee. No, I didn't have any. I was just going to do stand up. My
right.
whole career is an accident, you know. I got dared to get up on stage to do stand up because in the mid 70s, you know, these comedy clubs were coming up. I'm from Toronto, Canada, and, mm-hmm. and the comedy club came up there. And
was it Yuck Yucks back then, or
it was Yuck, and it still is.
Yeah. All right,
yes, it still is Yuck Yucks. So I went in the mid 70s when disco was all the rage. I was not into disco. I'm not a clubber. I don't mm-hmm. go dancing. I don't like dancing. I don't play poker. I don't do sports.
Right.
Really boring. I'm a post country.
And I mean,
we went because I hadn't been to a live stand up comedy show.
Yeah.
You know, I'd seen in Toronto Second City, mm-hmm. which was sketches, but I had not seen live stand up beyond the Tonight Show. So I went, and it was fascinating to see somebody live, you know, riffing and telling jokes
yeah.
and saying things that seemed in the 70s, you know, pushing the envelope like I had never seen beyond the, you know, the language and what they were talking about. It was hysterical. It was electric. It was alive. And then at the end of the show, the host got up and said, you know, Monday nights are amateur nights. And the people at the table that I said, you should go on. And I went, oh, okay. So I showed up on that Monday.
It's important to have those friends, by the way, to give you that little extra boost, right?
It could have been the end of it, you know, of the friendship, because it could have went, because I didn't really plan on what I was going to do and what
so
was going to happen.
You didn't have notes or anything like that? Or did you have any sort of idea?
I never did homework in school, and there was no reason. I don't have a GED. So I went, okay, I'll show up,
yeah.
because they said I'm funny.
Right.
And so I went up, and that was the beginning of my career. I mean, it was just the first time I heard a laugh was, you know, like a warm blanket. You know?
Holy
this
shit.
Is it. This is.
Right.
Yeah. Holy
yeah,
shit.
Yeah. It's incredible.
This is it. And still not an inkling of this could be a career.
Right.
So I would show up 3-4 times a week, and they were giving me spots, and I could do this voice. And, you know, I would talk as in this baby voice, Bobby, but I would talk. Filthy,
right.
talk about filthy things.
So
and the
funny.
Juxtaposition of, you know,
yeah,
you know, the filthiness in this voice.
By the way, yeah, I feel like having that voice is 90 some percent of it, because it's like
it
insert filthy thing
yeah.
because the voice is so spot on and believable as
yeah.
a yeah, like what kind of thing? So would you have the baby?
I mean, I'm laughing.
I mean,
yeah, and there's not even a joke there.
Yeah,
it's just to have this voice.
It's so innocent.
Dracula. You know, so I used to get laughs, really easy laughs. But anyway, I forget what the question was, but I'm going to continue to answer.
The voice of Bobby. So you're doing it on stage.
No, it was the voice of Skeeter.
Yeah. Yep.
So I started doing stand-up. When I came out here on vacation to Los Angeles on vacation, I went to the Comedy Store to see the mecca
right.
of comedy.
Because this is what year then?
78, 77, 78.
So who's going up at that point?
Yeah, who's their guys?
The MC is David Letterman.
Holy shit.
So pretty much nobody's.
Nobody.
Yeah, just know, hacks.
And, Brad, we're trying to get Dave on the podcast.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah. So David Letterman, Billy Crystal, who was doing soap at the time, Robin Williams. I'd see Rodney Dangerfield working out his Tonight Show sets in the other room. It was like really the Mecca. Johnny Carson would stop in to work out his sets for the...
Just like played, the Tonight Show monologues?
Vegas? No, Vegas. He was doing Vegas. I watched. I'm going to jump ahead when I made it out here, not like to live. Not I hadn't made it. Mm-hmm. I would go every night. I watched Richard Pryor go on every night and work out his set for Live on the Sunset Strip.
Oh my
which
god!
Which kind
that,
of was
that set
the most moving, career changing time in my career because I saw what. It was like to
saw the best.
I did see the best, and he is certainly the best, and he is my inspiration. But the bravery in being able to get up on stage and work it out,
yeah,
right.
You know,
and you
and
see
learn
the process,
and listen, and watch the process, and you know, it was
because
just,
up until that point, you were maybe not as fearless. Do you is it safe to say? Or,
I didn't understand.
Yeah.
You know, everything was happenstance. It was by accident. You know, I went up and I acted goofy. You know, if people remember me from the 70s and the early 80s, the truth is, I got up on stage the first time unprepared. Mm-hmm. You know, and what I learned from that, and then I got really nervous because I went, ladies and gentlemen, Howie Mandel, there was a light in my face and all these people, strangers are looking at me. And I went, oh my God. Okay. And I started doing okay. And they started laughing at okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then I went, what? What are you laughing at? And my act was really.
You would kind of smack yourself in the head.
Nervous.
Yeah.
Neurotic
crazy
Jew.
Energy, asking them what they were, and just, and making weird noises and laughing. And it was just fear. It was a. Total fear. But what I learned was the honesty of, you know, letting something die, if it does die, talking about the fact, you know, if people see you struggling, even if you're struggling and you admit you're struggling, there's a relatability
they're on your side,
that kind of worked. But anyway, so I started doing these voices on stage and I was doing them at the Tonight Show and I went in and auditioned for Muppet Babies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the one voice I was doing. So I did Skeeter.
Yeah.
Did you audition for Jim Henson?
I did see Jim Henson.
I mean,
I
man,
for Jim
a
Henson.
Hero of mine.
A
so,
hero
I mean,
of mine.
Oh, my God. What was that?
It's amazing if you go do, if you go in New York to.
The Creature Shop or what?
If you go to do Fallon.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Down the hall from Fallon, and it's been down the hall from, you know, when Letterman was there I first saw it. The very first Tonight Show was in that stage, you know, that I think that's where Steve Allen did his show.
Yeah.
And Jim Henson, who was just a puppeteer, and it was way before the Muppets became what they became, was a guest on the Tonight Show. And in his dressing room, which they have since opened up on that floor, in his dressing room, they ripped off the wall and Jim Henson... out of the pipes and the plumbing, he made Muppets. He drew what later became like Beaker and Kermit, and he drew all those there. And he's got it all. It's all Jim Henson's art. He goes, you know, he was waiting 2 hours or 3 hours to get on the show from the time he went in and rehearsed.
Yeah,
couldn't shut that creativity off
on the pipes. And now they have that wall open. If you walk down the hall, they will show you. There's a plaque on it. I think it's part of the tour where you can see Jim Henson waiting, creating all that art.
That's unreal.
Just scribbling in his downtime.
Yes,
and
it's brilliant.
Yeah, he was a genius.
He was a genius. So I went and did that, and then.
Did he? I mean, how did you read for him? And did he give you direction, or did he? You just kind of did the voice, and he was like, "That's great." Or
yeah, and that was it. I got that. I don't remember that being such a long process.
Yeah.
But he just thought that would be cool for Skeeter, and we had a read through. I actually auditioned for somebody else, but then I met him at the first read through of the Muppet Babies.
And do they give you the because I read for a lot of animation now, and that's like a dream of mine. You know, now that I have nieces and stuff, all I want to do is be a voice of a cartoon.
Right.
And you know, a lot of times you get the, you know, picture or a description of the character. Is that how it was? Or sometimes
they gave me a picture of the character. But Skeeter was already this is Muppet Babies.
Yeah.
So Skeeter
right.
was already a character that. Existed,
right?
But
so
not,
now
Scooter's sister, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Scooter's sister.
So now you just have to do the
and
kid
I,
version
and I did
of that.
And I did Animal because I had heard Animal, so and I did Beaker, you know,
which is the really
too?
High.
No,
If you don't listen to me, I'll make your sister disappear.
He was a scientist. The
That's right.
Scientist with a lisp.
Oh my God. Scientist with a lisp.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who? And then Beaker had like a buddy that
Bunsen
was
Honeydew.
And he was the high pitched one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
He was the me, like yes. That one, right? Okay.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All right. Sorry. I'm trying to get all my ducks in a row here.
Those ducks. Those Muppets.
True.
So anyway, I did that show. And my friends who were Second City, Jim Stahl and Jim Fisher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jim Stahl is on Mork and Mindy. He played Mindy's brother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or he was, I think he was even the mayor on Mork and Mindy. He was a good friend of mine, and I knew him from the Comedy Store. And Fox was going to start their network. They started their network with Joan Rivers doing her late night show.
Right.
And they wanted to start a Saturday morning Fox Children's Network.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a development deal because they're great writers. They wrote a bunch of movies. And if I had Google in front of me, I would figure out which movies they wrote. But they're
Air
really
Bud 7?
Sure. Classics. We're
talking about classics. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so they had a development deal, and they had a development deal for Saturday morning for cartoons.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they came to me and said, we should do Bobby as a cartoon. And I went, how the fuck are you going to do this
foul,
foul mouth little? They said, well, no, we use that voice, but
right.
What if we, and we just sat down and we said, well, they said, there's got to be a million funny stories. And then we thought Bobby Generic, which is just generic. Why don't we do this generic 4-year-old
mm-hmm.
who's, you know, I had babies at the time. We were all kids for a few years earlier in our life. And
hope so.
Said, let's tell our real stories, and we can do it through our imagination and like what we will become the, you know, it would be our fantasies.
Yeah.
So we pitched it, and they said, okay. And then, you know, I would sit there and talk like this, and this is Bobby. And I'd sit there with an artist who would draw. He goes, you think you look like this? And I go, no, I don't look like that. I got black hair. And then they would do that, and he would draw. He
That's
drew
amazing.
It, right?
What a fun process.
A real fun process. And who would think that it would run for 9 years? It would Jeez. Be a precursor to like Rugrats.
Which yes. Yeah. You set the table. You were like the new kids on the block
Steven
of children's cartoons.
His right. TV Guide said it was his favorite Saturday morning cartoon. It ran for 9 seasons in 60 countries. And
well, because like every children's show is always adults talking at the kids and kind of like, hey, we're going to do some fun stuff today. We're going to go over like
right.
it's talking at the kids. Bobby's world was, no, this is the kids' perspective.
Yeah.
This is,
or just a real perspective.
Yeah.
I think they understand. You don't have to talk down to kids. Kids
right.
would like to think up to us.
Sure.
So we did what we thought was funny. We did our takes on pop culture. In fact, I'd love to relaunch it one day, and there's talk of that now.
Ooh.
And then my friend who I worked with on Bobby's World, and I had worked on another show called Laugh Tracks, which was a sketch comedy show with a bunch of people who went on to become pretty famous, but Frank Welker was on it. And Frank Welker is the Mel Blanc of our time. Frank Welker
oh, wow.
is, if you look, he's every character, every cartoon character.
Just every voice.
Think.
Yeah.
He has every voice in every movie. They were doing Gremlins.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought me in to just meet because they needed a million voices.
Sure.
And they showed me a picture of Gizmo.
Yeah.
And again, I just did the Skeeter voice. I did the Bobby voice because.
So yeah, I was gonna say like, how many were you at this level where you were in like the world of working voice people because of the success of Bobby's World? Is that
did at that Bobby's World? I was never in the world of successful voice. I've never been hired for anything beyond. You know, I did Muppet Babies. Mm-hmm. And Dave Coulier ended up taking my place. I kind of backed up because I was doing a lot of stand-up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had a series, and I started doing movies. So I backed out of the last, I think he did the last 2 seasons.
Right.
And he,
solid replacement.
He mimicked my voices.
Yeah.
And then I did Bobby's World, which is just me, you know,
right.
doing Bobby and myself. And then I did Gremlins. I'm Gizmo from Gremlins,
yeah.
which is the same. But I didn't. I've never done anything.
And that
else.
Job came because you knew Frank. Is that
Frank Welker?
Yeah,
yeah. Who got me into that and
Shit.
Introduced me to Joe?
That
Dante.
Stuff really plays a factor in all this. Yeah, like just having any sort of relationship.
Yeah, it's you know this is you know it's funny because there's no better. Power in this business and nepotism, and you don't have to be related, but
no.
if you know somebody,
yeah.
it's just, you know, it's like, it is like our gang, you know, all our friends get together and let's put on a show.
Yeah. yeah.
And I love that camaraderie.
Right. And people want to work with fun people that they're used to working with. So if you show up on set one day and you're a great person to work with and you're easy to work with, then they're going to want to hire you for the next thing, or when they're going to think of you when Frank goes to Gremlins and says, "Oh, we need more voices."
Well, he got me the audition.
Yeah.
And the audition was in Burbank. I'll never forget, in a building, you know, that's where they were doing casting, not a show business building. In fact, on the floor where they were auditioning for the Gremlins voiceover talent, it was the same floor as a gynecologist's office. And there were sounds. I don't know which.
That's
one
the office we're going to use when we cast Ghost Country. By the way,
Ghost Country.
Yeah, it's the gyno office.
See? And ladies and gentlemen, this is the circle of life. We go from cartoons to cunt. I think we're going through
from cartoons to cunt.
Believe that'd be your
we're
next
still in
book.
The seat. Yeah. Can we move in? We're going to talk about D's. Dick. We'll talk about dick.
Let's go down the alphabet, man.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Why not?
All right. So then, same thing with Gizmo. Do you? Is it a where you get to kind of talk out maybe how you see, or do they give you a?
No, that movie was done and completed.
Gotcha.
I watched the movie, and we had to, for lack of a better term, lip sync to what was going on. And so we would sit in a sound stage and watch the movie from a booth and with a microphone. And, you know, what do you think he's saying here? I mean, they knew what he was saying, but how do you think that would sound?
Right.
You know?
Did you ever feel like fucking with the voice and maybe not doing a sound, but maybe doing like a, "Hey, it's me, Gizmo, a.k.a. Tony Danza," or doing like a, and just putting some actual character to it?
There is, like.
Some real dialogue. I'm sure
there's
tapes.
We added things because in the big crowd scenes, I did Gizmo. And what was funny about Gizmo is it wasn't really, you know, besides saying things like light bright, which was, take off on light bright.
Yep.
You know, because, when it played, it became a huge international success and all over the world. They
Incredible.
Wanted people to be able to relate to it. So they would bring me back in, you know, a month later because we're doing it for Germany. And, you know, those
Gizmo in German,
right? So, or Japanese.
Yeah.
So he had to sound like we would redo the movie, like my part in the movie, so that he would sound like some little German. You know, like something sounds
angry
like,
Gizmo.
If you could only see how his face as he's doing German Gizmo,
you know, or Japanese. You know, you had to make him a little.
What about Jewish Gizmo?
I love that when you were doing German Gizmo, Adam as a Jew still got a little fearful.
I'm sweating a
just
little.
This like a it's cute and it's cuddly, but it's still that it's still that dialect.
I had a Gizmo doll. That's how you know how. I mean,
did you have a Gizmo or a Furby?
Ooh,
see,
I'm.
Do you know what Furby is?
Yeah, I'm positive it was Gizmo.
Yeah. Furby. I think there was a big lawsuit. They asked me to do the voice of Furby.
Really?
They didn't.
Well, because it's the same.
It's the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing. They watched that and they said, instead of brown and white, let's make them purple and have the eyes roll in the back of the head, and then we're good.
And then we're good.
Was there ever a time after doing all these, like doing Gizmo and then Bobby? I mean, it wasn't. They wouldn't like at the end of the show put your face up at the end. So like, were you kind of? But I mean, you were out there with your stand-up, obviously, right? So like,
you know,
you were
what's really my career has been so fractured in the sense that. When I first started, one of the first things that got me national recognition was Make Me Laugh. That's where I, that's the first TV I got. And then I got known as a stand-up comic, and I became an opening act for like Diana Ross and Earth, Wind & Fire and
Holy
Jose Feliciano.
Shit.
Yeah.
Billy Ocean ever?
That's kind of later. That's way later. I didn't ever open for Billy Ocean,
not with that attitude.
And then I got a young comedian special.
Yes, on
and
HBO.
That was a game changer. And on my young comedian special, it was me, Jerry Seinfeld, Richard Lewis, Harry Anderson.
Oh my God!
And Maureen Murphy. That was my young comedian special.
What Mary fuck lineup. Kill, huh? that's a great lineup.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that kind of so then people knew me as the insane manic comic. And then, you know, and I was touring and I was doing theaters. And then when I got Saint Elsewhere.
Right, which is a drama.
Which is a drama.
Yeah.
You know.
Medical drama.
Yes. Regardless, it's still a drama.
Right.
Medical, cop, whatever. I played Fiscus on Saint Elsewhere for 6 years. That audience was a very, you know, the people that would watch Saint Elsewhere, they would stay up at 10 o'clock on a weeknight to watch a very serious, well-constructed, fabulously scripted drama with Denzel Washington and Norman Lloyd and great classic actors and me. We're not the people that were watching young comedian specials and goofiness. So I would get letters. That's when before email. I would get letters saying, "I have a bet with my husband that that Fiscus is not the same guy that puts the rubber glove on his head."
And you're depending like, on sorry.
If they would split the money with me, I would say whatever they wanted me to say. So I did that. And then when I started Bobby's World, you know, young moms and dads who were watching cartoons with their kids. You know, I was in the live action opening and closings of it.
Yeah,
but those weren't the people that were watching dramas at night. They weren't the people that were watching stand-up comedy. So when I would do a stand-up comedy show, I'd get a bunch of moms sitting there with like three-year-olds. Because they said Howie Mandel. They knew Howie Mandel.
Yeah.
So my audience was really fractured. So there's people who are Bobby's World fans. There's people who were saying Elsewhere fans and movie fans. I did a couple of movies in the early 80s. And then there were people who were stand-up fans.
Yeah.
And they were very separate. And it took years and years and years. Not until I did Deal or No Deal.
Mm-hmm.
That was the biggest widest swath of like everybody who
kind of brings everyone together.
That brought everybody together where I had one fan base where they go, "Oh, you know, you're Howie Mandel. I know."
Right. So now you think when people come to see your shows, they know what they're coming to see. They're not coming
absolutely
to see.
Absolutely not.
Really?
Because still, as somebody who is probably more widely known, you know, you hit more of an audience with AGT as a judge, and they remember Deal or No Deal, they think of me as this kind of clean-cut host.
Right.
But as a stand-up comic, and that's something that I'll never stop doing, it's very improvisational. It's very in the moment. Mm-hmm. It's not family-friendly. I love stand-up and will never give up stand-up because that is my one primal scream. Everything else I do, you know, there is a mark to hit, a line to recite, a commercial to throw to, a
producer
sponsor,
in your ear.
A producer telling you what to do. Yeah, and there are sponsors who don't want you to cross the line. And I feel like in stand-up comedy, it's about crossing the line.
Yeah,
it's about being free. It's about being... So, you know, if you think... And not that I'm going to offend anybody, not that I set out to personally, but I just want... I love this free kind of spirit.
You want the freedom where you're not going to be in your head when you're telling a joke thinking, "Ooh, that would be really funny, but then that sponsor might pull out of..."
Though, you know, and I say that to you now. The truth is, I think our climate is changing, and it's really depressing the world of stand-up comedy now because
of the because of the social media.
Social media.
The quick response
PC
for people to...
Yeah, right. Quick response. And
the amount of uninformed blogs or sites that are not credited. That, and we're in an age too where people don't fact check. So if it's posted on Facebook and a link that says like this comedian did this, people will immediately just go, "Well, it was posted on Facebook, so he must be a piece of shit."
The term social media bothers me because the media used to be something that you had reverence for.
Yeah,
you know, the media, at least for us who go into media, media is television, television reporting.
Yeah.
It is journalism, which is newspapers and that. But now social media, what is social media? It's some guy in his underpants in his room writing what he thought he saw.
Right.
And that little spark, that little tinder can, no pun intended with the tinder, that starts a fire. And we have no, and I hearken back to what we talked about earlier. You know, I watched Richard Pryor try anything and everything to get that right. And the art of comedy is the art of free speech and poking fun. And if you can't poke fun, if you can't throw a miscolor on your canvas and go, "Oh, no, I got to tone this back a little bit. Oh, I got to curb that." If you can't do that without somebody recording you and then taking what you say out of context and judging you and the possibility of you losing sponsorships and jobs and whatever.
Yeah,
it's a scarier place.
It's this thing where now, I mean, I saw a great interview with the late, great Patrice O'Neill, and he said comedy is about having the freedom to fail.
Right.
We have to be able to go up and talk about topics that are not traditionally funny, the darkest things ever. But we can kind of make that funny, but we need to be able to fail and a few times to finally get it right. Now you're up on stage and you look out and you see people who are smiling, but also their phones are up and you're like, "Great. I can't."
And like, then they'll show that little video to somebody and they'll critique it based on like what was happening, A, off of that small little video, and then B, you know, they won't give it their full attention. That's my problem with it too. And it's also like the people that'll sit back and judge are people that would never, they don't even give any sort of validity to the idea that somebody is got to a point in their life and career where they will be so fearless as to try to bomb, you know, or to say something. It's like they're not even taking.
I don't think most people have a sense of humor. You know, I did a book, no, but they don't. I don't think that is a sense. It's like, do most people have fashion sense? Do most people right. have, you know, or do they have a good sense of, you know, the word sense is mm-hmm. what is key here. And for to be a comedian. To have a sense of humor isn't about, you know, telling a joke. The reason that I can tell you that most people don't have a sense of humor is the reason for the laugh track. You know, that is the industry's way of telling the audience that that was a joke, laugh here.
Laugh here, yeah.
Yes. So the point is, and if you hear the rhythm of a joke, we mm-hmm. kind of know the rhythm, so we know to laugh at that. But the people that construct jokes and have a sense of humor, mm-hmm. you and you, mm-hmm. That always comes out of darkness. It's always got to come out of something that's not funny. And I've said this a million times. You know, comedy is not really, it doesn't come from anything fun. I mean, even if you take a little kid to the circus and you see the clown fall down,
right.
you're laughing at somebody else's misfortune.
Sure.
They have found a way to make, and when two guys walk into a bar, something shitty has to happen to somebody.
Yeah.
For you to laugh.
Yeah.
Comedy can't be, hey, me and Adam went out to a bar, we had two drinks, we had a great conversation, and then we got home safely.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just home in Seattle with my 2 6-year-old twin nieces and my 2-year-old nephew, and I will do a lot of puppet stuff with them because they're still at the age where they right. are all about it. And there's this chicken puppet that I have, and I was playing with my nephew and talking to him, and then with a crayon, he proceeded to beat the chicken mercilessly, and my nieces started laughing, and he started laughing. And right. I'm like, yeah, this is funny to you guys, but it's also animal cruelty. It's also fucking, you're beating him with a crayon, which is a new way to, you know, you're taking this, you know, artistic tool and turning it into a weapon. But it's like that was, they don't, they
there was
as,
a victim there.
Yeah. But the truth of the matter is, that is funny.
Mm-hmm.
And why is it funny? Because it's taboo.
Well, because the voice I was doing of the chicken was spot on. It's also, it's also the trailer voice for Ghost Hunters. Okay. So, yeah.
But yeah.
But the point is that that's funny. Yes. But you cannot have cruelty to animals. You know, people are so sensitive on TV, or if you mm-hmm. say you did, it's a joke. We're not killing a chicken. That's right. not a real chicken.
Yeah.
That's not a crap. But that wouldn't fly with sponsors and everything. Kids with a pure sense of humor know that it's funny. Why is it funny? Why are they? Because you're not supposed to do it. Taboo, mean, hurtful, awkward.
That's a great point.
Embarrassing.
They know that you're not supposed to do it.
All the elements that makes great comedy. And even if you look at old-time comedy, seltzer bottle in the face.
Yeah.
Pie to the face.
Pie in the
yeah.
face. You're ruining somebody's clothes. You're ruining their time. You're ruining mm-hmm. their party. If you take away all the
Three
humor,
Stooges.
Three Stooges.
Dude, blowing up the glove on your face.
Yeah.
Right. But they're hitting each other. They're yeah. hurting each other. That is comedy.
Yeah.
Now, the idea that a large group doesn't find it funny. You know, I've talked about this too. When you go to amateur night
mm-hmm.
and you watch somebody bomb horribly, and you go, "Oh my God, why is that?" You know, who told him
right.
that he could get on the stage? The truth is, somebody did tell him.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. somebody laughed, and I think that the people like you and me and all of us were really lucky that our sensibility—and that's all it is—that our sensibility is shared by more than just Uncle Morty.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
our friend.
Yeah.
The fact that you're not doing anything on stage that you don't think is funny and you haven't found funny. But there are people that won't find it funny. You know,
absolutely.
I'm always cognizant of the fact. I remember one of the greatest days of my, and this is how I think, one of the greatest days of my career was I sold out 2 shows at Radio City Music Hall.
Holy
good
shit.
Lord.
One night.
Yeah.
You know, and it's probably 7,000
yeah.
Seats.
At least.
So it was 14,000 people in New York City. And I remember looking out the window in the corner of 6th Avenue and 14,000 people were there, you know, 6,000 coming out, 7,000 coming in.
That's an epic venue. I just saw Chappelle there last year, and it seems like the best for stand-up.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It mm-hmm. was amazing. And my wife was, I was with my wife, and my wife was saying, isn't this amazing? And my mind went to this, but this kind of speaks to it. 14,000 people bought tickets to see me
right.
in a city of 10 million. You know, so 9,985,000
right.
people decided there's something better to do than to see how
Jesus
it ended
Jesus Christ,
and
man.
And that kind of speaks to the fact that, you know, the guy who gets on stage on amateur night and says all this crap
right.
that nobody's laughing at in the silence, he has an audience of one. The fact that I got up there and my nervous energy and I blew a glove up on my head, and which many people would argue is not funny and is not even comedy, is nothing, was shared by enough of a mass that I could pay my rent. So we're just really lucky that some people share the same sensibility. It's like, how many people like a song? How many people like a painting? How many people like you putting these words in that order?
Just like any form of art. There's, it's fascinating to me that if you go to Rotten Tomatoes and you go to the movie Goodfellas, which I think is one of the greatest movies of all time, it has a score of 99%, and you look and there's one critic that just says, nah, this is horrible. Fucking Goodfellas. One of the most perfect movies of all time. Someone is able to look at the same piece of art and just say, nah. And as a comic, you're right. That's going to happen where you're trying to just appeal to people find it funny as many as you can. But there's
relatability. You know, we're all human. And we all suffer from the exact same, you know, maybe for different reasons, anxieties and pressures and things like that. And if we could just tickle that, just poke that, and that's what we look for, just relatability. And the way to find that is within yourself. You know, if you are true to yourself comedically, you know, like what makes you laugh, what you found really awkward, hopefully there's somebody else out there, another human being that kind of relates, and that makes you laugh.
When you,
humor comes from the darkest place. How many times have you laughed at a funeral? You know?
Yeah, because you're just, and it's almost like the mind is craving it in that moment. And one of my favorite things to do on stage is to make it very tense in the room, because then the release is so much bigger. When you have a moment where you stop talking for a second, and then you listen, and the entire comedy club, or in your case, theater, is silent. You're like, ooh, I've got them.
And they're listening, yeah.
Yeah.
They are.
Like,
well, silence is golden. It really is. No, but it is.
It is.
I love it.
Did it take you a while to get to a point? I'm curious, too, like, at what point did Howie Mandel hone in on your sensibility and become aware that, oh, wow, there is, like, a mass of people that are have similar sensibilities as me?
I'm still coming to grips with that. You know, the truth is that you're always trying to...
Because you say, like, on these shows, like Deal or No Deal, or even AGT, like, that, you know, you're not maybe as free as you would be on stand-up, that's safe to say. But you're still, I still feel like I'm still seeing, and even talking to you now, I still feel like that's, you are who you are on TV. Like, I don't
think
like you're...
You are, but, you know, what I found is to not get so inside it, even in comedy, and just do it, and then hope, you know, it's beyond you. And I'll give you the example of Deal or No Deal. When Deal or No Deal was offered to me, I said no fucking way. I got a call and they said that we want you to do a game show. And I said no. And you got to put this in perspective. In 2005, you know, as a stand-up comic, the irony of being a, you know, that's a kind of a punchline
to be
a game show host.
It's almost like kind of like being a cruise ship comic where it's like, oh, you're a comic, but you do cruises, then you must not be doing well. Or like, you're a comic and do a game show?
I didn't want to do it.
Yeah.
They said, well, just can we, and they phoned me back and they said, can we pitch you the idea? NBC is going to give this a push like they've never given. Nobody has given five nights of primetime television on a network to this. This is the biggest format in the world. You know, America was like the last one on board. This was all over Europe.
Oh, really? It was a
huge hit.
Yeah. Oh, shit.
All over the world.
So that made you listen a little bit?
A little bit. And I said, no, I just don't want to do a game show because I want to be a comic. I don't want to be the punchline. I want to be, you know, I'll act. I wasn't really acting at the time. And they said, will you just listen to the pitch?
Yeah.
And I said, okay, I'll hear the pitch. And then I was at Jerry's in the Valley.
Nice.
I don't leave the Valley. That's why you guys are
you love it out here. You know, I love it.
I'm a Valley.
Hey, man, any place that has pictures of you and Oprah, I will stay as long as you let us.
There's a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. It's incredible.
This is, I got a warehouse of
pictures. It's a great shot. There's Bobby dolls. It's pretty
amazing.
Look at
that. Yeah. I want to show you. I'm pointing out things on a podcast.
The Howie Mandel show.
Don't take these cards.
Yeah.
So when I first got my talk show, there was a pile of cards. I asked to do my talk show on the set in NBC where Johnny Carson did his show.
No shit.
Which later became Access Hollywood. So I was on, I put my desk where Johnny Carson put it, underneath the bleachers, which are still there, were these cards. And that is from that's Johnny Carson's last show. That was the last.
Because
it says Robin Williams, Bette Midler.
Bette Midler.
Yeah, and do not take these cards. And Bob was his cue card guy. That's the last cue card from the Tonight Show.
Holy crap! Because Bette Midler sang "One for My Baby," "One for My Baby," "One for the Road."
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
That's an incredible.
And that picture beside it that you see, the Howie Mandel show. That's that set.
That's amazing.
And right next to it, you have a pre poster for Ghost Hunters. This is maybe. Wow.
I'm always. Always looking ahead.
Howie, that could legitimately be in like some sort of like Smithsonian. Yeah. That's an incredible piece of Hollywood history.
You know, and that was my first show on the set, and they weren't big then. And if you look, Jennifer Aniston was my first guest on show, and she was dating Brad Pitt, and they told me I can't mention Brad Pitt. That was the first show.
First rule of knowing who Brad Pitt is don't say his name.
Right.
We can't even say it three times on this podcast.
What did you think of The River Runs Through It? Did you see that? They got really mad at me. And that's Usher, who was not a big star then.
No.
This kid is going to be great,
right.
See, I knew it.
And then there's Arsenio.
Jay Leno was across the hall, mm-hmm. and he came to wish me luck on my first show. So that's this thematic.
Yeah. Amazing.
Did you love, we'll get back to the Deal or No Deal story, but real quick, did you love doing the talk show?
I love doing it.
Yeah.
I did. Mm-hmm. You know what? It turned out not to be a great experience. I'll tell you why. Because they asked me to do a talk show. I was filling in for Regis at the time, and they asked me to do a daytime talk show. And then in daytime, I was so excited to do it, and I wanted to fuck around and be... Again, this goes back to being yourself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they made me dress in suits. They made me... I don't wear earrings now, but I was wearing earrings. But
right.
It's indicative of, them shaping you, and it's always about this business. It's always, you're perfect. Now you're not gonna do this.
Right.
You can't say this. You know, we're gonna give you Jennifer Aniston, but can't ask the question that
about
you're even
Brad Pitt.
That anybody or yourself is interested in.
But be
in.
You. Be the Howie that we love, but don't say Brad Pitt ever. And don't
right. So yeah. In that
and
way it was not mm-hmm. fun, because I felt that's why I still love doing stand up because there isn't a
you're not answering to anybody.
I'm not answering to anybody.
You
and that's
talk about Brad Pitt as
and
much
that's
as you
why
want.
I wanted to get off of Universal lot and buy a shitty warehouse in the Valley where I could just come and do whatever it is that I
no
do.
No one's checking up on you.
Nobody. And if I have an idea,
there's no studio tour going by.
Yeah,
we go. We have our own equipment. We shoot things. I have edit bays.
No one's saying, "Hey, Dr. Oz needs this space."
No.
like you're
so
fine.
I can do whatever I want.
I love
this
that.
Is where so Deal or No Deal. Yeah. This is what I learned. So
you go to the pitch. They go, hey, at least come right.
I'll show you that here too. The guy shows up at Jerry's. He says it's mm-hmm. the biggest thing in the world. I'll show you that on the wall. He brings. It looks like a special needs kid did an art project. Like this is supposed to be the biggest format in the world. I'll show you it. It's here. It's on the wall in the other room.
Okay.
He made an art card that he thought was. That looked like suitcases, and he showed me the show.
Yeah.
After showing me the show, this is pre me seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing. You're right. That's not it. There's no talent. There's no skill. There's no nothing.
It's luck.
An hour.
It's averages.
I go, open
that's
the
it.
Case. Just that's my line. Open the case.
Yeah.
What number do you want? Oh, 7. All right. Open number 7. Now, okay. What number do you want now? 4. Okay, open number 4. And an hour of that.
Yeah.
An hour of that.
You're like, right. How am I supposed to make that
entertaining? Yeah.
So anyway, I go home and I tell my wife. She goes, listen, why don't you want to do it? I said, it'll ruin my career. She goes, you were at Jerry's and now you're home. That is your career. Take the fucking deal. So I go,
God bless your wife.
Yeah. She's the smartest one in our family. So I took the show. And I tell you, I wanted to quit. You know, I went there. And I said, this is another thing. This is so show business. So I said to the guy, because the guy's telling me, you know, the reason we called you 3 times, we can't do the show without you. You are so mm-hmm. perfect. You're the one for the show.
Yeah.
We won't do the show if you don't do the show. It's amazing. We got to have you do the show. This is on a Friday. So when I call him, I said, well, do it. I go, when do you need me? He goes, well, we're shooting Monday. I go, you're shooting Monday? Well, don't you have to build a set? Don't you have to build a set? He goes, well, I have a set. We have the set built. Okay. I said, well, don't you need models? Oh, they're already hired.
You're like, but Monday's Rosh Hashanah. Yeah.
No, but the point is, how far down the list as my fucking name if this thing's built and waiting?
Right.
Obviously, just, like 8 other people have quit.
Yeah.
So that starts to seep into your brain?
A little bit. So then I say to myself, I call my comic friends, and I say to myself, this is how I'm going to handle it. The only reference I have to great comics that have done games in mm-hmm. the close what's his name? Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
Did the word name that? Remember he did
password.
No. Groucho Marx did a show where the chicken came down.
I know what you're talking about. I don't know.
I've just seen tape of it. I never seen it. It's before my time. But Groucho Marx was a guy. He was like a movie star. He was a comic, and he had done a game. And I know that Johnny Carson had done it. This is like two generations prior to me.
Sure.
So I'm going to hire a comic to write with me, and I'm going to sit. And they said I can have a comic. So I had a comic who sat down with me, and we were writing. Because I said, how am I going to fill the fucking hour about opening cases? And
right.
Was it a buddy of yours who was like, just knew your voice, or somebody who maybe had written for shows?
With, you know, and we're going to do this show. And anyway, Monday comes, and that's another picture. All these pictures are not just, it's not narcissism. They're reasons, but I'll show you after. But
also, you got to have stuff like this up to, A, for podcasts. But
the podcast,
well, to reference
on camera,
but also like, how would, I mean, I feel like having this, the career you've had and the body of work and the, as you said, even at the beginning of this, podcast where you said it was like an accident to see all this stuff and see the different,
like the different
worlds
stages,
that you've gotten to
stages
work
of your
in,
career.
Why would you not want to be reminded of that?
So, here's the thing. So I get to the set. I have this whole thing planned. Mm-hmm. And then we open the show. Like the first show, I'm going to shoot six, all right? So we open
in
the show.
In one day?
We're shooting one in the first day.
Yeah.
But I walk out, and they go, you know, and there's this big dramatic opening where I start in the vault, and I walk out, and then they go, and they only have to answer that one question, deal or no deal? And I say that, and the audience roars, and, you know, because they were told to. And then I bring up the first contestant, and I'll never forget. I could tell you right, Karen Van was the very first contestant, and I'm standing there, and this woman, beautiful young lady, is standing there in front of me. And you know, I've said, and you have to also realize, besides Who Wants to Be a Millionaire at that time, there's no other shows for $1 million
right.
dollar prize. Somehow today doesn't seem like a lot on TV because there's a lot of them.
Yeah, but then it was big.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I think $1 million is still huge in people's minds, but a $1 million game show is something that we see a lot of.
Yeah.
But we didn't then. And I said to her, you have a chance to win $1 million. And I'm standing 5 feet from this person, and I realize, oh my God, this is a real person. And I interview her for a minute, and she introduces me to her three kids.
Right.
And her husband. And she's never owned a home. They're paying rent. They have no health insurance.
Shit gets real very quick.
That's exactly right. Shit gets real. And I figure, you know what? It doesn't matter. It's not about me being funny now. Yeah, I can get the best joke in the world, and I can get the biggest laugh in the world, but this is a real person, and with three
she's not going to find it funny, and
so
if she doesn't...
So my whole cadence changed. I said, I'm not going to... I just got, and I realized that when you watch people who don't know, people who aren't in television or in show business... There is something that happens to people when they, regular people, when they're on a set, there's 20 cameras, there's 500 people, you could see a glaze go over her eyes. Like, oh my God, I'm in another fucker. You know, she wasn't from Hollywood.
You can forget to breathe.
Right. And people will tell you that when they're on the stage. I'm sure if you go to a concert and your biggest crush pulls you up on stage, you're going, oh, how?
That's why
like
people faint. Yeah.
It's like and I could see that there was a glaze in her eye just about being there and being given this opportunity. So my whole cadence changed. And it was about, you know, I would say like there's an offer would come in and I would be really close to her and go, Karen, the offer is $200,000. SNL started making fun of me and my cadence and how I.
Which is awesome.
Which was great.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm telling you, the reason was I could see she wasn't. And I wanted you to hear. And really what I was saying is take the fucking money. You know, and they
would they ever try to, with the producers in your ear, maybe like, hey, Howie, don't.
That, stop. Because I would say things like. You can now take $200,000, or you can still take a chance at $1 million.
Yeah, and you say that quick and throw it away.
Or go for a guaranteed
change your life.
Right.
Get a house
down payment.
$200,000 mean to you?
Stop
You've never had that.
Yeah. Right.
Or you can take a chance at $1 million.
A shot.
A chance.
Not guaranteed. Yeah. Chance.
No. Guaranteed.
Chance.
Yeah. He would be really mad at me for doing that. But what happened is, and I dropped up by the wayside all my ideas for witticisms and being funny and making it about Howie Mandel.
Well, because you started caring about these people.
But what happened was, like comedy,
yeah.
my empathy kind of that I think part of the, you know, the relatability of that show was you played along, you were screaming at the TV.
Yes.
And I had more fame and more, I mean, people were offering me stand-up gigs and everything mm-hmm. that I was doing a lot more. A lot more than there's somebody. You hear that noise?
Yes. So, yes. Someone's making coffee.
No, don't apologize.
It's okay.
Somebody
start over.
With
Jesus.
A Keurig machine making cappuccino. What are you making, Mike?
Just a coffee.
Just a coffee. Nice. The sound you hear in the background is Mike Marks. He runs our very astute executive producer.
Wonderful.
He's making coffee. That sound is not him peeing in the corner.
That's what it sounds like. I just wanted to. But anyway, what I was saying was the empathy that mm-hmm. I ended up the it's okay. We'll wait till he's finished. We'll wait till he's finished. You think it's done?
These mics are good. I don't think they'll pick it up.
Oh, you don't think they'll pick it up?
No. Yeah.
There's a lot of noise behind me.
I asked the guy when I buy these mics at Guitar Center, I go, will we hear coffee made at Howie Mandel's porn studio? And he mm-hmm. goes, Howie does porn?
Yeah, Ghost Country. Yeah.
Softball lob.
Okay. If really? He just takes that. Hold on. I also have to tune my tambourine. 1 second. 1 second. I have to do that.
A whole quartet comes in.
Yeah.
Can my a cappella group warm up here?
The four tunesmen?
I know there's going to be like a crushing splash and bang in a second. What?
I have a. And if you spill, don't worry. I'm going to bring in the wet dry vac. It's going to make no noise whatsoever. You're fine.
Call somebody else to help you. You need help? Yeah. Timmy! Timmy! He's having trouble with the coffee. This guy behind us is trying to be so quiet.
Yeah.
I've never heard more noises come out of this. No.
See you, Mike.
Bye.
Parties at Don Francisco's house were less noise.
But what I was saying was the I didn't know that, so I did the show.
The amount of empathy you were saying, too.
I threw out all my jokes because it's so important that this human, this real human being,
sure.
better her life,
right.
have an opportunity. My fear became that if I do a joke and I get a big laugh and mm-hmm. at the, you know, she may focus on the laugh and not really focus on
the fact that she get about to get $200,000.
I don't want anybody, God forbid, the worst thing that could happen to me is somebody saying, the joke, I didn't even think I had four more cases to open. Oh. You were doing so fine. And that killed me that I could even
did that happen
day,
once and that's what?
No.
Okay.
But to this day, you know, the NBC, who I love and has supported me, has asked me to do that, what's that show they do with all the games? Celebrity Game Night.
Yeah,
Hollywood Game Night.
Hollywood Game Night.
And I won't do it. And they go, why won't you do it? And I said, because to go on television, I want to entertain. And mm-hmm. because you have a real person there that's on the team with the celebrities, if I did something and distracted, and even if they made $50 less,
right.
I would cry. Because it would be for me. I don't want to be. I'll go out and entertain somebody, and I'll act like a goofball, and I'll do anything you want. But I don't want to be responsible for somebody else.
Nothing at risk.
What?
Yeah, you want to put.
That's,
yeah,
because so you're a great dude.
So what happened on Deal or No Deal mm-hmm. is we did the show. It was about to air, and I, to my wife, I said, we got to leave the country. I went out. I went to South America when it was going to air.
Okay.
I didn't want to be any place. I said, it's terrible. Mm-hmm. They go, why? Because I was so inside it. I said, I don't think it's. I spent the whole time making sure people won money. I didn't do any jokes. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything.
You're known for comedy. Now you're not going to be. Is that what you're thinking?
No, but I didn't know that it was. I didn't trust the format in itself. And most
trust your instincts that you admit.
Well, I just did what Howie Mandel would do, mm-hmm. but not what a comedian would do, not what an actor would do.
And that was a new thing for you to.
Well, I just bared my soul.
Yeah,
that was just me.
Yeah.
But I was relating, you know. So I start getting tweets. I start getting emails, and the first night it aired, they go, "This we just broke a record at NBC." The next night it aired, Tuesday, we broke another record from the night before. The next night, and every it went up. Yeah. And I flew back. I landed in Miami. I'll never forget it. I walk off the plane within, you can count to 10, somebody goes, hey, deal or no deal? And from that day forward, my life in
that's
this business
fucking,
has changed.
Yeah.
It caught on. But it was something that in the moment, I was so serious and so worried that somebody, you know, would be not offended, but be distracted. And it was just about making sure they won money. I didn't want to be a game show host.
Right.
I didn't, but it taught me a lesson, you know, just to be real. Mm-hmm. And just to be, you know, do what you do, and you can't control how other people respond. And in the same way in comedy, you can't control. Be real. Do what you think is the funniest fucking thing in the world. What is making you laugh?
Right.
If you're going into the toilet, tell them you're in the toilet. Just
yeah.
do that. You can't control the rest of the world. And what I learned from Deal or No Deal is from that time on, I've been so free just to be myself. It was such an eye-opening experience, you know, and those experiences are mirrored in other things. You know, when I did Howard Stern once and accidentally admitted that I had mental health issues.
Yeah, with your OCD, yeah.
With my OCD.
That was an accident that you talked
about? Oh, yeah. He was fucking with me. He wanted me to open the door when somebody was in there playing with their cock and they had touched the door, and he knew mm-hmm. that I didn't want to touch germs. And finally, I got an anxiety attack, and I said, listen, this is real. And that was years and years ago before people were very open about mental health issues.
Sure.
And I said, I'm fucked up. I go to a psychiatrist. You got to open the door. I'm having a panic attack. I'm going to have a heart attack. And I thought, I was devastated. I thought, you know, my career is over.
Right, you're like,
my
great, family is it. This is the thing.
But it kind of opened up to, you know, I've told that story before, but I walked out in the street. I was going to run into traffic, and somebody walked up to me and said, I just heard you on Stern. And I went, holy fuck, that's it. This is the beginning of the end. And,
mm-hmm.
and they went, me too. And I thought, oh my
wow.
God, I'm not alone. And,
yeah.
But all this speaks to comedy, and it speaks to whatever we do. We're all humans.
Mm-hmm.
We all have a cross to bear. And if you just are true to yourself, if you think it's funny, and even if it's tasteless, if you think it's, you know, if you want to go on stage,
you got to try, right?
Yeah, you got to try. But back to how this started,
mm-hmm.
our society as is not allowing us. And it's a shame because, you know, young people are out there fighting a war for freedom and democracy. And our biggest freedom is freedom of speech. And when we have to be concerned about what we're saying or poking a chicken with a crayon, then that's not really freedom.
No, it's not. And
shit. Your son does a vlog, right?
Yeah.
Is it, share these sentiments with him as he's, you know.
Well, my biggest fear, and I do, you know, I want him to be free. I want him to be artistic. I think everybody's creative. I think everybody's an artist. I think it doesn't matter. You don't have to be a comedian. You don't have to have a podcast.
Yeah.
You don't have to have a vlog. Mm-hmm. You're an artist in what you do. You know, you got to find a new way, maybe find a way that feels better for you, like it's never been done before.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I we all, our world lives in fear of what other people will think. So this is a dichotomy because I want you to be fearless, you know, and I tell my kids to be fearless, go for it, do it.
Mm-hmm.
Just find something you're really passionate about, you know, and I don't care if that's a fucking waiter. You know,
yeah.
Just do it and be the best fucking waiter you can be and look forward to get up in the morning and just go and do it. But by the same token, this is a very scary world in the sense that you are an open book to everybody, whether you're vlogging or not. You know, you walk into a urinal, the next guy's next to you has got an iPhone. So you're not, he could capture whatever he wants to capture.
Sure.
Nothing, there's no private time anymore. And how is that information processed? So I want to warn them or educate them, but not scare them. But I want him to.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. You say you don't even have to be a comedian. I mean, there's that story of a businesswoman who is flying to Africa. She's not a comedian. She's not an actress. She's not in the public eye. She goes on her Twitter and she goes, "Hey, flying to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS, but I'm not because I'm white. Send." By the time she lands in Africa, this has been retweeted.
Somebody comes up to her and goes, "Deal or no deal?"
But this has been retweeted hundreds of thousands of times.
Yeah.
There's a hashtag like "When Andrea lands."
Holy shit!
Like, and when she lands to find out that she's fired, that her fiance has left her, and just like all this because she hit send. And she's not an entertainer. It just caught on and was like, how insensitive that this person has said this thing. So to elaborate on your point, it is scary. And not just for people that put themselves out there every day, but then for people that don't. Like, you, anything that you do now could be completely blown out of proportion.
Well, I'm curious.
Everybody is so that everybody becomes part of the media.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious, too, like, just how cautious now with the success, you know, Deal No Deal, and then now AGT, which I don't know if you can even compare the two as far as what they've done, you know, show-wise and for your career, but I'm assuming, I mean, that's, it seems like it's just as powerful and popular.
It is. What's amazing to me, and nobody's more thankful, blessed, and surprised than I am, that, you know, today I can walk outside and somebody knows my name or has seen something I do. Because, you know, when I came in this business in the mid-70s, you know, or I got to do the Johnny Carson show, my life changed the next day. But there was three networks. And if you did TV, we knew everybody on TV. You know, mm-hmm. you knew. Do you know who Donnie Most is?
Yeah.
Okay. So my point is, that's a third-tiered actor on a sitcom. That's a third-tiered. It's not the star of the sitcom. It's right. a guy on a sitcom. I will ask you now, who named three actors on CSI, which is a number one sitcom? Can you?
Ted Danson? Is he still on there?
But you don't know him from the but
Chris
stars.
O'Donnell?
Okay, here's the point. The point is you got to go yeah. Okay?
Right, yeah.
That's a number one show, and people don't know.
Ask me the cast of Designing Women. I'll give you the whole cast from top to bottom.
So the point is that right now, the average home has 600 stations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have internet. They have live streaming. They have gaming that they can do. They can play games on it. So just the fact that somebody knows you, that wants to show up, that sees you, and is phenomenal to me. So the fact that I'm on a TV show now that, yeah. you know, 10, 12 million people tune into.
Yeah.
Nobody's luckier than I am. The fact that I'm my age and still, you know, a lot of the comics that I started out with, you know, I could give those, you probably know because you guys are in comedy, but those are names of people that were great that people don't even know. People right. like Tim Thomerson. Do you know who he is?
No.
You don't know?
Can't say that I do, no.
Oh, well, he one of the best improvisational comics there ever was. Fuck, you know Jeff wow. Altman?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, same at the Comedy
yeah.
Store.
Yeah. yeah.
But I'm saying he was great.
Right.
He
and you see guys like that and you're like, why aren't they more?
But they were on the Tonight Show.
Right.
People knew their name and they were given shows and, you know, and then, the, you know, you have your time.
Some people, it happens and some people just, right? I mean,
but it happens and goes away. Yeah. You know, careers mm-hmm. are in ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
And here I am sitting here after all these years. And at this particular moment, I'm on something that people know. And any time I'm on something that people know and I can have a good time, I wouldn't have even dreamed that that was a job, what I'm doing now on AGT.
Right.
You know, you could be on a talent show, but just to sit there, I always want people to laugh and smile.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting there watching a show that I'd be watching alone at home in my underpants anyway. now I'm there.
Commenting the way you would comment.
That was yeah. good. That was yeah. good.
That doesn't seem like a job.
Yeah.
Do you think it is the two moments I'm curious too big? You'd say just to be lucky to have that job, but like also to be like when you Drew Lynch, who's a you know comedian, and that whole moment. I mean, that seemed like it was pretty
awesome. You know, to be witness to just as good as I think it is to watch on TV, but even to be there live,
it's way better when you're in the room for any of this.
Oh, my
yeah.
God, to be there when somebody's dreams are unfolding in front of you. Mm-hmm. You know what this means to somebody.
A similar right. energy to Deal or No Deal when you're with them and the money's at stake, right? You're seeing these people on stage.
Well,
with
and the money. You know, you open up the four times in 5 years and 500 episodes that I opened up that case that they had, that they remained with, and there was $1 million.
It happened four times?
Four times in 500 shows. And when I opened up that case and that person is standing there, their life was never going to be the... I had such a small part. I mean, that was luck, right?
Yeah.
Such a small... But just to be there and witness in the room, that energy, that electricity. I mean, if you're sitting in a room by yourself doing work at a desk and somebody's in the doorway mm-hmm. watching you, a family member, you know, you get a sense that somebody's watching you or somebody's in the room. I think humanity gives
sure.
off an... You know, kind of
some
electricity.
Some sort of energy that
there
you kind of, yeah.
So our energy in life changes, goes up and down. And this sounds much more spiritual than I even mean it to be. But when you're in the room and up close to somebody whose life is changing, exploding, every
right.
dream is coming true. When you're in a room with somebody like Drew Lynch, and for those that didn't watch the show, he was a guy who got into an accident and he
softball hit him in the throat. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah, and now he stutters. So being able to express himself is harder, and he's chosen the path of stand-up comedy, which is all about communication.
Right,
and he killed it. He crushed it. That audience was standing. That audience was screaming. The tears were rolling out of his eyes, and I got to press the golden buzzer to send them all the way to the Radio City Music Hall. Just to be a small witness to it was enough than to be. I would have been happy to be in the audience.
Sure.
And people told me, you know, I could see on social network what it was like to watch it. It is amazing, and it feels like a privilege.
Well, and whether you go to Deal or No Deal or America's Got Talent, you've got to witness, like you say, how many times can you, in someone's life, can a moment happen and you go, okay, my life was one way until this moment, and then from here on out, it's going to be a completely different thing. Maybe, you know, when your kids are born,
yes.
when you get a crazy new promotion or a new job or in your case, when you give someone a suitcase full of money, a contract to appear, a development deal, they win a competition, you're there for that moment where nothing is ever going to be the same again.
Usually those kind of life-changing moments, as you just pointed out, are usually private. And in, you know, my most life-changing moments, my two most life-changing moments, positive and negative, were the birth of my children and the loss of my father.
Yeah.
You know, both of those weren't, you know, for public consumption. So the fact that I'm part of something that is, I believe, equally as life-changing for these people, at least in the context of what they're doing and in their lives, to be there is amazing.
Yeah.
And that's why it makes for good television, and that's why they broadcast it.
Yeah. And do you have some sort of special soft spot for the comics that come on?
Yeah. You know, it's not even a special soft spot. It's a knowledge. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge is this, and you both know this as comedians. You know, we are given the short end of the stick.
Sure.
We really are.
Yeah.
Because people do not understand. They just think, you're funny guys, you know?
Yeah.
There you are, and you're just going up and talking. And it's, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, I saw him win an award, and he said it best. He really did. He did this whole dissertation on, and I'm not going to do this justice, but I'll tell you, it's Jerry. They give him an award for comedy achievement.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, it's funny, because as a comic, we don't really get accolades and awards. You know,
no.
Even Johnny Carson, who supposedly celebrated comedy, you had to be waved over to come sit down. But
yeah,
Donnie Most would come out and sit down and talk about how he got into character. Or a singer would come out and sing a song that they didn't write,
that
they're just singing, and then they'd sit down on the couch. But a comic, you know, and even the clowns in the circus are coming at the end, and they clean up, and they're used as filler in between the
You have to be waved over.
But he said, it's very funny, in our business, you know, the people that get awards, and the most important night of show business is the Academy Awards, which gives awards to people who act. And think about the actor.
Mm-hmm.
So an actor will get up, and he or she will be driven to wherever they have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And where they have to go, somebody will dress them. They'll help them get dressed. They'll comb their hair. They'll put makeup on them. And then they'll be sent into a room. And in that room, they'll put a piece of tape on the floor. And they say, what I need you to do is, when I tell you to go, I need you to walk in and stop at that piece of tape.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And when you get to that piece of tape, then they give them a script. And they go, I need you to say
the ghost is inside that vagina.
No, but I need you to say these words.
Yes.
Right.
So they walk in. And they stop at the tape and they say these words, and the director goes, cut, no, try it again. That wasn't good. You know, and then they do it again, and then they do it again, and then they do it again, and they do it again, so that the director can get like a really good angle. And then they go take that into an edit bay, and they cut it, and they put music under it. And you watch the guy go to the tape, not say any word he was going to say. And they go, fucking brilliant. That guy's brilliant. A comedian.
Mm-hmm.
A comedian writes his own material, creates his own character, does his own performances with nobody. He's self-directed.
Decides the order in which he wants to deliver it. Yep.
And has to elicit from a group of strangers a response every 30 seconds. Not an easy response. Not just a pattern.
On the first take.
Yes.
You can't be like, you know what?
That's it.
I didn't say that joke right. Let me try that again.
They go, that was funny.
Yeah.
But the thing about it is, you know, it's very funny, because even when the comedians are hosting all these award shows, they go, he didn't do such a good job.
Yeah.
You see so-and-so's dress. Yeah.
Oh, my God. You're so right.
And ultimately, you know, I remember one.
Seth MacFarlane Alan wasn't funny, but Gwyneth, did you see Gwyneth?
Yeah, but we say they're brilliant, and yeah. In the Academy Awards, people get up and if they're going to make a political statement, they go, "That is so that you don't do that at that night. This is a very pious
right.
night. This room is filled with people who pretend for a living,
and they're brave. Oh, the bravery, Howie,
and brilliant.
They're so brave,
and we'll take political direction from these people who pretend,
yeah. right?
But comics are nothing, and so my empathy is I understand what goes into it.
Yeah.
I'm not making more of myself, but it's just harder to do
sure.
to elicit laughter and to maintain a career in comedy than it is. You got to be lucky as an actor to get the part. And I'm not taking away from, there is a talent mm-hmm. in pretending, but there's also a lot of help
right.
that a comic doesn't have.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And maybe somebody will take this statement out of context.
How he
doesn't think actors are
how,
talented.
How he says, F you, Gwyneth.
Yeah, yeah. Is that why you still do? Because Rich was just telling us you have about 100 dates still a year.
I'll never stop doing that. No matter what I do at least 100 tour dates a year.
Mm-hmm.
I think if I'm going to be on television, if I'm going to make television, I produce, I write,
yeah.
I perform.
You did our buddy Theo's show, Deal With It, which is so good.
Thank
Theo Long,
good
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think for me to have the sensibility, even as a comedian or somebody who does television, I think you lose it living here in L.A. and New York and just being behind the scenes of... This is not the real world.
No.
So
right.
to stand in front of an audience in Iowa, in Oklahoma, in Illinois, mm-hmm. in where the world is real, and even through their sensibility of their sense of humor, you kind of get a sense of what people are responding to.
1,000%.
And you look at a lot of TV that's on now, the reason the networks are going into the toilet is I don't think they're speaking to the average people, the people that we have to speak to as comics who get on a stage in front of those people.
Somebody told me that Adam Sandler, somebody asked him, like, why do you make movies like Grown Ups and all this? He's like, I make movies for middle America because that's who goes to see them.
He's absolutely right. That's why he's successful, and that's why he deserves to be successful.
Yeah. Right. I did want to touch. Yeah, I did want to touch very briefly on your book. Because we both read it, and my dad has OCD,
right?
And so we've talked to Mark Summers on this podcast, and we talked to him about the OCD, and to me, it's the most fascinating part about meeting with someone with that condition is that they all know it's crazy, but they can't help it. Like they can't.
That's why it's debilitating,
right?
If you didn't know it, and it was just the way you acted, and if it, the fact that it seems like you're out of control, you're controlling, you're obsessing, and you mm-hmm. compulsively have to do things, and whether it's rituals or thoughts or, my cleanliness or whatever it is, the fact that intellectually you know that this is not right, that it really doesn't matter, is what kills you and creates anxiety, and I just wish, it's something that I continually struggle with. As I talk to you, I'm medicated and I seek a lot of help for it, and mm-hmm. it's hard, mm-hmm. but everybody's got a hard time, and it's just about coping skills, but there's been so many times when I've been caught in the wheel of hell mm-hmm. of trying to get out of some sort of skipping record.
Well, and my biggest question to you then is, how does someone with OCD and ADHD sit down to write a book? Because that seems like something that you
was one of the hardest things I had done.
Yeah.
It took over a year, and I had an editor and a co-author with me.
Mm-hmm.
What was his name, Rich? Who was traveling with me? His name's on the book. Anyway, we'll get his name. Is it here, the book? No. That's what I... All right. So anyway, he traveled with me, and like you're doing right now, we sat down and talked, and he always recorded.
Okay.
So he just kind of, it is my voice, it is my words,
mm-hmm.
but I had somebody curating and putting it in.
That seems like the way to do it.
Yeah.
Especially for a comic. Down. Yeah, because we talk.
He was on the road with me.
Yeah,
it's awesome.
So in the hotels or at lunch, it took a year mm-hmm. of just recording everything I said and then just transcribing that.
How many times would you go through and maybe just read the whole thing and be like, oh yeah, this is, I think you transcribed this.
Well,
he
would transcribe, what we talked about last night.
Yeah.
And I'd go, you know what, that shouldn't be, what's his name?
Josh Young.
Josh Young.
There we go.
Yeah, it's Don't Touch Me. You can get it, I guess, and, I mean, the audiobook is what I listen to, which was
The audiobook's
fantastic.
On iTunes. The book's on Amazon. You can go to aboutlastnightpodcast.com, click on the Amazon banner, and then order Howie's book.
There it is.
And then go see him when he
HowieMandel.com, is that where all your dates are?
I came up with that, yes.
Well, I mean, Howie, just having this conversation with you has been so great because... A, you're an immensely talented guy, funny guy who I saw do stand-up a few weeks ago, and I had never seen you actually do stand-up before.
Right.
And that was so great to see you, and because I know you from Bobby's World. I know you from America's Got Talent. I know you from The Game Show. Even though I know you're a comic, I don't know you. I've never seen your comedy. So to see you be funny and still just... kill that audience. You had a great set that night.
I don't remember how the set went. I know that when I saw you, we were at the Laugh Factory. I was writing. We were going to do...
Yes.
I was going to be hosting one of the galas at Just for Laughs for the CW. I think that's going to air. And so I had to find material. So I went from club to club to club doing that, and that's where we met.
It's great that you still... Rich was even saying when you guys were up in somewhere in Canada where you would be having coffee, and then you would pop in at a club.
A comedy club, I just like to... That's where I write.
Yeah,
you know, that's how I write.
Because you're doing big theaters and stuff when you're touring, yeah.
Right, but writing, I really don't know. You know what tells me if something's funny? I mean, I think something's funny, but if I hear the noise of ha-ha, then I know it's funny.
Yeah.
So even if I have an idea, I got to get in front of people to do it. So I look for after a theater. If I'm not tired and there's a club around, I'll drop in on the
It's
club.
A different energy, right, in the comedy club versus...
I love it. Yeah. I love the intimacy of being right there and seeing somebody's face and just the immediacy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's great.
I mean, and just seeing the broad spectrum of your career, whether it be game show host, whether it be hidden camera stuff, whether it be children's television, whether it be stand-up, it's really cool to see how many things you've been involved in. And like we said before, how many fans... how that broad spectrum of fans that you have. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what Ghost Hunters does for you. I think it could really take you to that next level, and I'm really hopeful that that'll happen for you. You absolutely deserve it.
We didn't even get in, and maybe we can do this next time, but like the prank aspect of your life, and I know it's a big thing, but
right.
I want to maybe just ask this question. The clearly Oprah is a pal of yours.
No, that was me. See, that another highlight. That was me. She, when Deal or No Deal took off, she wanted to play it. So we went out to Chicago. We did it on her show, on the Oprah show. That's playing Deal or No Deal with Oprah.
Holy crap.
Yeah. That's how big it got.
It got huge. It huge.
How much money does Oprah have to win for her to get excited?
She was doing it for a charity.
Oh, okay.
Now, here's a question.
See, those are all the other things. I don't know if the next picture over is me. That's me in a line. I'm the second one with the shiny shirt. That's the 80s. I hosted Expo 86, the World Fair, on the same shelf as the Oprah picture. That's Charles and Di. I did a show with Charles and Di. For Charles and Di.
Wow.
How was that? Cool. Were you nervous?
Who is this idiot kid, you know, who really doesn't do much, you know?
Is that how you still think of it when you think of this stuff?
Yeah.
Like when you see his pictures, you're like...
My wife and I, every day, I never dreamed I'd live in California. I never dreamed I'd be in show business. From that amateur night at Yuck Yucks, there I am with Charles and Di. There I am with Oprah. There I am on the point of these pictures is that was the set of The Tonight Show. Johnny Carson was iconic in my house. You know, everybody watched The Tonight Show. That was the show. And that's, you know, I got his cards. You know, everything kind of, you know, Bobby's World right there. You see the Bobby's World thing?
Yeah.
That's the Happy Meal. We were the biggest seller.
Oh, that's right,
dude. I was a Bobby's World Happy Meal. In 1 week, they told me they gave out, we set a record, 40 million toys. So 40 million little, this thing where I sat in the room and I told you where the guy's going, I'm going, oh, this is what he sounds like. And they're going, does he look like this? That was in every McDonald's. McDonald's was the biggest thing. That picture right behind you, that is Karen Van. I just looked at it.
Yeah.
That's the first episode, the first time I walked in stage, right here, the bottom one.
Yep.
And that's where I'm just staring into her eyes going, I got to throw out all my fucking jokes.
Now, not to knock you down a peg, but 40 million kids did buy those toys, but, you know, billions more didn't buy those toys, Howie. And that's
to me.
Yeah.
Welcome to me. I know that. That goes unsaid.
Yeah.
Howie, thank you
so much.
Yeah,
this was
thank
so
you,
fun.
So that's the show. You know.
it's me, Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast with Brad Williams and Adam Ray. Boy, they're a lot of fun, huh? Why don't you subscribe on iTunes to this fucking podcast? Give them a 5-star rating so this midget and this Jew can feel good about themselves for a couple minutes. Also, get on your iPhone or Android and get the podcast app. You can also listen to it on Stitcher or aboutlastnightpodcast.com, where you can hear past episodes with great guests like Lisa Kudrow, Paul Feig, Kevin Nealon, Bob Saget, Dion Cole, Chris D'Elia, Adam Devine, Michael McDonald, Jaleel White, Bud Friedman, Steve-O, Harlan Williams, Tom Arnold, Ron Funches, Rick Glassman, Blake Anderson, Anders Holm, Jessamay Peluso, Joey McIntyre, and many, many more. I'm Tony Danza. Thanks for listening to the About Last Night podcast. Good night. That's it, right? You got it? Sweet. Boy, it smells good in that booth, by the way. What kind of candle is that? Hanukkah Willow? Nice.